talk is entitled The Realization of Atomically Precise Device in Silicon. Michelle.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me at the back? Is that a yes? Okay, I'll try and... If my voice stops, just tell me, because I tend to have a habit of doing that. Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me here today. And really, what I want to talk about is some progress that we've had in the Center for Quantum Computer Technology, and in particular the Atomic Fabrication Facility, about making devices in silicon at the atomic precision level using scanning probe microscopy. And in particular, what we're looking at is making devices where we use single dopant atoms in silicon, and these dopants are going to be phosphorus, heading towards the qubits for the Kane quantum computer. But the beginning of the session really was talking about what happens as you cross over from quantum to from classical to quantum physics, and I guess really that's the kind of technology that we're trying to develop. This is the well-known Moore's law, where essentially we have the number of chip components on the left versus the feature size. And what we know is that the number of chips essentially doubles roughly every 18 months, and this means that the feature size obviously has to keep decreasing in size. And a lot of money is spent in industry to keep that law going. It's been going for about 3 to 4 decades now, and billions to trillions of dollars are now being put towards keeping that law going so that devices go below the 100 nanometer level. So one thing we can see on this graph is that this is a conventional kind of device size for the silicon MOSFET, but the feature size is around about 90 nanometers commercially. But obviously that's decreasing as time goes by. And what our group is trying to do essentially is to jump down about 10 to 100 times smaller to get down to the single atom level on the right-hand side here. And this is an example of some lithography that's been done in our laboratories. Essentially, we have a silicon surface that we've hydrogen terminated, and using the hydrogen as a resist to come along with the STM to pull off single hydrogen atoms to act as our lithographic mask. And one thing you can see very clearly is also you cross over from the classical to the quantum age. So really, the kind of devices that we can make, we can develop the technology to make single atom devices down here, we can actually head up and meet where industry's sitting now and try and see some of the problems that are essentially just ahead of them as they continue to downscale in size. If we look at some of those problems, they're starting to hit them already. So in a standard silicon MOSFET, you have millions, 40 million or so transistors, and they all have to work reproducibly. And this is kind of depicted at the top picture on the left-hand side here. So we're looking at macroscopic scale. We still have classical conduction in these systems. But once we start to go down in size to the mesoscopic scale, we're actually hitting the limits of technology in terms of making reproducible devices. And in particular, one of the problems that they face is getting a precise number of dopants in the device. And the reason why this is significant is the threshold voltage for each MOSFET is very dependent on both the number of dopants and its location within the device. So as they start to make them smaller and smaller, they're finding that the conventional top-down lithographic techniques to make these devices are now producing devices that are no longer identical. And in particular, the threshold voltage from device to device is changing. So the error in the number of dopants goes as root n. So if you're sitting at a fairly large device, where you've got tens of thousands of dopants, if you lose 100 or so, it really doesn't matter. But once you get to these very small devices, where you only have about 100 dopants, if you lose 10 of them, then your error becomes about 10%. And really, that's one of the problems that they're facing right now. So industry is looking at technologies beyond CMOS, and they're really looking at all kinds of different things, molecular electronics, carbon nanotubes. But obviously, one of the things that people are trying to do is actually build devices from the bottom up, where they actually put the dopants in place. And that's really what our program is all about, to put the dopants in place with an SCM so you can actually see where they are, know the location of the device, and the number of the device, the number of dopants in the device. And obviously, at this very small scale, then quantum effects start to dominate. So there's a whole load of new physics to be discovered as we go down to making single-atom devices. Well, obviously, the idea of using single-atom devices and manipulating atoms on a surface has been around for a number of years now, and there's some beautiful results on the top left-hand side here, moving iron atoms around on a copper surface, which was back in the 1990s from the IBM group. And using this kind of technologies, they were able to actually identify for the first time a wave, an electron wave, on the surface of a metal atom. Well, that's been done for a long time, but still there remains to be very few devices that are coming through that are made at the single-atom level that actually survive outside of the microscope environment. So a lot of them are actually made inside the microscope and tested inside the microscope. And obviously, if you want a functional device, you want to actually get it out of that microscope environment and use it in the real world. Well, semiconductors prove difficult in this regard because the bonding in semiconductors is very strong. They have strong covalent bonds. And to try and move atoms around with an STM is very difficult. It can be done, but you have to apply very large voltages, and that tends to disrupt the crystalline lattice of the silicon. I've got an image here on the bottom left-hand side of a silicon 100 surface, which is a conventional surface used for devices. And you can see this is a scanning tunnel microscope image where we have essentially three terraces. And if we zoom in on those terraces on the right-hand side, you can actually start to see the rows of single atoms. On this particular surface, it reconstructs. We actually have rows here, or essentially pairs of silicon atoms called dimers. And this is the surface diamond surface, where we have essentially a strong covalent bond, which is what makes it difficult to move them around. And then the dangling bond from each silicon atom overlaps to form what's called a weak pi bond. And that weak pi bond actually allows us to do a lot of surface chemistry and get into the lithographic regime. So the strategy that we tried to develop, and this was proposed, I guess, back in 1999-2000, was to actually use the STM to pattern the hydrogen resist on silicon. And I mentioned one of the first things that you have to do is to make something that's going to be compatible with a device that you can take outside of the STM at the end of the day. So the very first thing you have to do is make something, a marker in the surface, that you can actually use once you take the device out of the system to actually see where you've patterned the single atom devices. And I'll come in to describe why that is not an easy achievement to get towards. But once you've got those registration markers, you put your crystal into the STM, which is an ultra-high vacuum environment. You flash it to about 1,200 degrees, and those markers have to survive that flashing. And then you come along, and you essentially break that weak pi bond between the two silicon atoms, and you grab hold of a hydrogen by putting atomic hydrogen into the system to passivate the surface, and it makes it very unreactive. And then you come along with your STM, you pulse the voltage on the STM tip, you break the silicon hydrogen bond, and you expose the dangling bond out of the surface, which is very reactive. And now we bring in our dopant gas. The dopant that we're using is phosphine, and throughout the talk I'll explain why that's quite an amazing dopant source, but essentially it's just pH 3, we leak it into the system, and it reacts at those dangling bond sites to adhere to the surface where we've patterned them. We then do something called a critical anneal to incorporate the phosphors into the surface to make it secure, before we then have to get rid of the hydrogen resist. So we now have our patterned phosphorus layer in the surface. We then want to encapsulate so the device is now robust, we get rid of the surface states, so we can take it outside of the UHV system, encapsulated with our dopants beneath the surface. Obviously, we want to do this at a temperature so that dopants don't diffuse or segregate to the surface. And then finally, using these registration markers, we put down contacts to our particular device. Well, this is the strategy that we have been developing over the last 3-4 years, actually since 2000, 5 years. And I guess when we first proposed this, a lot of people were very skeptical, because at that time there was no technology known to put single phosphorus atoms in silicon with any kind of atomic precision. In addition, people believed that if you encapsulated them, they would quite likely to fuse out of their position. And also, there was no way to actually get the device outside of the STM to actually contact it in the real world. So the very first thing we did was actually design a system to be able to do this. And I guess there's only a few things I want to highlight about this. Essentially, it's a scanning tunneling microscope system on the bottom here, coupled to a molecular beam epitaxy system. And with the STM, there are essentially three things that we developed. The first, and probably the most important, was we had to make the sample sizes large enough so that we could actually process them in a clean room. So a typical STM has a sample size of about 3 by 9 millimeters in diameter. And the reason for that is that you actually want to reconstruct the surface by getting it to 1,200 degrees. And the way you do that is pass a very high current through the sample. And that causes the surface to melt. When you go to much larger sample sizes, the currents you need are very, very high. And it's actually been very difficult to do that. So one thing we've developed is something called an E-beam source that actually heats the surface up to give us atomic resolution imaging on a large sample size. And those samples can now go through a clean room and be processed in the normal way. The other thing is we've attached a scanning electron microscope to our STM. And that allows us to come in, take our sample from outside with the registration markers, and bring the tip down using the STM to where the markers are on the surface. So we can actually pattern with respect to those markers, so we can then take it out of the machine at the end of the day. So that allows us to find the device as we take it in and out of the vacuum system. And then finally, we couple it to an MBE system so we can actually encapsulate it. And obviously, if you want to have something like a quantum computer, you want to have very high-quality crystalline silicon with very few defects or impurities in it. So you need something like MBE, with all the pumping speed that it has and the very low pressures that it has, so you can get good electrical-quality silicon. And that, the reason why that is significant is that an MBE system, typically to get to those very low pressures, has lots of pumps and are vibrating, essentially. So the whole system is stainless steel. The system is vibrating at a certain frequency, and that's attached under UHV to your SCM where you're trying to do single atom manipulation. There's quite a lot of design work in getting the system working. Now I'm going to go through to show you some of the results that we've got in fabricating these systems. I guess the first challenge that we had was to try and identify what does a single phosphorus atom look like on the surface. If the promise of SCM is that you can make single atom devices, then you have to really prove that you can distinguish a phosphorus atom from any other feature on the surface so you know exactly where the dopants are on the device, to be convinced by the electrical results at the end of the day. And I guess that's one of the problems that faces quantum computation in general, is actually understanding the environment of the qubit that you're looking at. So we went right back to the beginning. We've got phosphine as our dopant source. And in the literature, there was a huge disagreement about what a single Foch's atom looked like on the surface. So the very first thing we did was we just literally took a clean surface of silicon, very lightly dosed it with phosphine gas, and looked at the fragments on the surface. And the fragments here are highlighted in blue. You essentially get pH2, pH, phosphorus, and then the hydrogen that comes off from the dissociation products. And that's in addition to the defects that you would see on the surface. It sounds very simple, but actually it took a long time to resolve this issue, and it's something that's still ongoing within the group now. The reason why we like phosphine as a dopant source is that it doesn't stick to the hydrogen resist. It only sticks to the dangling bond sites on the surface, so it's very useful from that respect. So how do we identify what those different features on the surface are? At the moment, I labeled them very nicely in that last graph, but I said there was a lot of problems in the literature as to which was a phosphorus atom, which was a pH2, which was a pH atom. And the way that we did this is we started working very strongly with a theoretical group at the University of Sydney and the University of Newcastle, two separate groups. I guess one of the key people there was Oliver Warshout, who was a quantum chemist that came along and said, okay, let's look at what one phosphorus atom and three hydrogen looks like on the surface and look at all possible combinations of those orientations that you can get, and do the same thing with one phosphorus atom and two hydrogen atoms and so on. And essentially, we worked out the minimal energy states from all these different configurations. So here are the configurations on the bottom. Here's one phosphorus and three hydrogens, one phosphorus and two hydrogen with different energy levels, one phosphorus and one hydrogen with different energy levels. And he worked out which was the lowest configuration state and looked essentially using density functional theory, simulated the images of what those features would look like on the surface, which is shown in the gray on the right-hand side, and then we compared them with the experiment. And by doing this, we were able to go through and literally identify pretty much every feature on the surface, and there is a large number of features that come from those dissociation products. And this really resolved for the first time exactly what was happening when the phosphine landed on the surface. And that work is ongoing now in looking at chemical reactions on the surface, and in particular, how does the phosphine, once it lands on the surface, how does it actually go from a phosphine molecule through its fragments to a phosphorus atom in the surface? This is another study that's due to be published this year, where essentially you've got a pH2 molecule, watching it with time associated with pH, and then finally going to a bridged hydrogen, a bridged phosphorus atom across two different dimers before it then incorporates into the surface. Now, why is this significant? Well, obviously, we want to place phosphorus atoms with precision in the silicon lattice. We have to open up a hole to get the phosphine to absorb. And one of the things we've been doing in the group is how big does that hole have to be to get one phosphorus atom to absorb? And if we want to make an array of phosphorus atoms, how much precision are we going to have in our lithography to get one phosphorus atom in each hole? So obviously with lithography, you can do very large-scale lithography, down to nanometer lines and down to these single atom sites. And I guess one thing we've been doing over the last years is figuring out, can you get phosphine absorption on a single atom site? And we found that at very high pressures, you can actually force that reaction. But in reality, in order to get phosphorus to incorporate in the surface where you want it to go, you actually need to open up space on the surface for the phosphine molecule to associate. And here on the bottom left-hand side are some beautiful results that were obtained a couple of years ago, where essentially opened up a patch that was about four to five silicon atoms wide. We phosphine dose, and then we perform something called this critical anneal. We call it critical because this really is the point at which the phosphorus atom is sitting on the surface. By annealing it, it actually goes into the silicon lattice, kicks out the silicon atom, and it's actually incorporated into the surface with three strong covalent bonds. And in this way, we're actually able to lock the phosphorus in position using this resist technology. Now, the crucial thing about this is the point at which the phosphorus goes in temperature is below the hydrogen desorption temperature, so you can keep the resist there and pattern your phosphorus dopants wherever you like. And as I said, we've been figuring out, if we open up different size patches, what happens to the absorption in these patches? How many phosphorus atoms do we get in? Can we control the temperature during this so we can actually get one phosphorus atom in? And that's ongoing work in order towards looking at scalable devices. Okay, we have our phosphorus atoms now sitting in the surface with this critical anneal with the hydrogen resist around. If we want to encapsulate them, obviously we want the qubit environment to be very good. So we want to get rid of any defect states around there, encapsulate them so they don't move. And in such a way, we have to actually get rid of the hydrogen. It's well known if you try and grow silicon on a hydrogen terminated surface, but it doesn't actually allow it to grow two-dimensionally. So it just clusters on the surface, and you get lots of interface states between different clustering atoms. So we have to get rid of the hydrogen. How can we do that? There are two different ways. The obvious one is just heat the surface up and get rid of the hydrogen. But obviously, every time you heat the surface, it's quite likely you're going to cause the phosphorus to diffuse. So we can actually do that, take it to about 470 degrees for about 10 seconds, and we can actually get the hydrogen to come off and the phosphorus to stay put. But what we do find is if we look at around the edges of this, we get a few nanometers of phosphorus diffusion out of that patch. And again, because we can now identify what the phosphorus atom looks like in the surface, we can actually watch that phosphorus atom moving away from the patch as we heat it up. If we want to go to true atomic precision, the other way we can do it is to use the STM itself. In the same way that we pattern the hydrogen resist in the first place, we can come along with the STM at a slightly higher voltage and just depassivate the whole of the layer with the phosphorus in it. This is what's shown in the bottom left-hand side here, and by doing this, we get to the point where we can now start to preserve single atom features in the surface. So all is looking well. Now we have to encapsulate, and again, I guess one of the biggest concerns that people had was when you encapsulate, you're going to have to put some kind of temperature down there, that was the belief, and that will cause the phosphorus to diffuse. One of the first studies we did was we actually looked at silicon growth on silicon at different temperatures, and we found that even down at room temperature growth, with no heating at all, you can get epitaxial silicon, where silicon essentially lands and follows the crystalline structure of the silicon underneath. Because there's no thermal energy, it literally clusters in three-dimensional islands, and those islands meet. And after a certain critical thickness, it will start to become amorphous. But below a certain thickness, typically about 10 to 20 nanometers, all the way up to 30 nanometers, you can actually get crystalline silicon. And that's really what our group's been following now. Okay, so we're encapsulating the silicon. Can we actually prove that the phosphorus is not moving during that encapsulation process? And one of the things that we've been developing is a technique called buried zircon imaging to actually see where the phosphorus are during and after the encapsulation process. So here we have STM lithography, where we've opened up sites for phosphine absorption. We then phosphine dose, perform our critical anneal, so the phosphorus is now encapsulated in the surface, get rid of the hydrogen resist, and then we encapsulate with about 2-3 monolayers of silicon at room temperature. If we look at a standard STM image, we don't see anything in this picture. It looks very rough, and it looks like the phosphorus is diffused. But if you now take your STM tip to each point on the surface and do an IV plot, and then differentiate that, you can get something called a CITS scan, which is tunneling spectroscopy scan, and from that you can actually see the image of the dopants underneath the surface. Now it's very difficult to prove using this technique how far they've moved, because each phosphorus dopant has some kind of envelope function where the wave function is spread out underneath the surface. So in order to prove how far the phosphorus is moving, we'd have to go to another technology, and that's going to come up in the next slide. But on the right hand side, I just wanted to show, after 4 or 5 years of quite thorough STM work, in combination with theory, we've now got to the point where we can identify a single phosphorus atom when it's sitting above the surface in this bridge site, when it incorporates into the surface into a heterodimer, when it's sitting in a hydrogen resist terminated surface, and this is a single phosphorus atom that's actually buried underneath the surface. So we can actually track the phosphorus atom during the whole fabrication process. Okay, so how far is it moving though? It's well known that segregation is a lot worse than diffusion. So if we could somehow measure the segregation of the phosphorus using our STM, then that would give us a handle on how far it's actually laterally moving as well. As I mentioned, having got to the point where we can identify the phosphorus atom through the whole process, we know what it looks like. So an experiment that was designed was essentially to take a silicon wafer, saturation dose it with phosphine, put as much as we can on the surface. We then encapsulate it at 250 degrees in this particular image, by about 5 monolayers. We then anneal the surface, and we actually watch the phosphorus segregate to the surface, come up through the surface during this process. And by plotting the relative phosphorus density of the surface versus the annealing temperature, we can extrapolate what's called the segregation length, how far it's moving. And we found at 250 degrees, it's moving about 4 to 5 monolayers. So it's actually very small. And if we actually repeat this for room temperature growth, we can actually drop that down to 2 to 3 monolayers. So again, this is giving us good confidence that the phosphorus is actually staying pretty closely to where we're patterning it during this whole fabrication process. Well, those are all the structural features, and I guess one of the highlights of this talk is how we're combining the structural images we get with the electrical images that we get at the end, the electrical device results that we get at the end. So another reason why phosphine is a great dopant source. If you take a silicon surface and expose it to phosphine gas, it self-terminates. So essentially, the phosphine absorbs on the surface until there are no dangling bonds left for it to absorb. Essentially, it forms what's called a relatively ordered structure. And when you heat the surface to 350 to get them into incorporate, we find that the density of phosphorus atom on the surface consistently comes to this 1.7 times 10 to the 14, 0.25 of a monolayer. And that happens from time to time to time. So we know the phosphorus atoms are now hopefully sitting in substitutional sites. So if we make something called a delta dope layer, where we essentially encapsulate that layer in silicon, take it out of the system, put down electrical contacts to it, we can measure the number of free carriers using the Hall effect. And the number of free carriers is exactly the same number of phosphorus atoms that we put in. Obviously, that bodes well for any kind of qubit state where you want every phosphorus atom to sit in a substitutional site. But now to get some idea of the electrical transport of these devices, as I said, we can put down different numbers of phosphine by changing the dopant source, essentially by changing the time, get different numbers of phosphorus atoms down on the surface, and change the carrier density. And by doing this, we've made a whole series of delta dope samples to try and work out what is the phase coherence length in these samples by measuring their magneto transport, and what is their mean free path. And the first thing you can see by saturation dosing, you get a very high density of phosphorus on the layer. So you would hope that it would be metallic.
it's still quite, it's still an insulator by definition. If you go to t equals zero, then essentially the resistance goes up. But if you look at the mean free path, you see it's only of the order of a few nanometers. So it's going to be very difficult in these devices to make ballistic devices. You have to go down below a couple of nanometers in dimension. But you can see that the phase coherence length, this is a 4 Kelvin result, it's about 18 nanometers. So these devices are very strongly phase coherent, and as you go to lower temperatures, obviously that's going to increase. So we have our electrically active phosphorus dopants. Now we need to come along and pattern those surfaces with the STM. I'm going to go through one of our results before I go on to a whole series of things that we're doing at the moment using this technology. So the very first result is a wire device that we've made that's 90 nanometers long. And this is essentially a description of the registration market process and how we actually pattern the whole device. So the first thing we do is we take our wafer and we etch these registration markers 300 nanometers down into the surface. We then put that into our SEM and we flash it. And these are some images of the surface. We bring our SEM, we put our SEM tip down with respect to those markers. And then we go through, we can actually image the SEM, image using the SEM those markers and the silicon surface near it. On the right hand side, you can still that we still get atomic resolution. We then go through that whole process. We put the resist down, pattern the resist, bring the phosphorus dopants in, get rid of the resist layer, encapsulate the silicon, take it out, and then make electrical contact to the device. And that's essentially the final image of the device. This is the 90 nanometer wire, it's 900 nanometers long. And you can see the different range of technologies that we've had to get to fit in order to get this device out of the system and working. That's the device that we're hoping to go to very shortly, replacing that 90 nanometers with single atoms. As I mentioned, the advantage of the SEM is that you can make, you can see the devices you're making it, but you can also make many different chips on the same wafer. So you can compare the process as it's going through to check which part of the process didn't work. So this chip was made at the same time as the wire. Essentially, there's no packing on it. We put down our aluminium contacts, essentially to nothing. There's no phosphine absorption there because the hydrogen resistors blocked it. And if we measure the IV characteristics through that, we can see essentially we get no conduction through that patch as we would expect. The resistance is about 10 gigaohms. And that's telling us essentially that the hydrogen resist is blocking phosphine absorption, so it's behaving very well as a resist layer. We can also strip off the hydrogen resist using the STM to expose the surface to a saturation dose of phosphine. And here we should get the same result as if we'd never put it through the STM process at all. So it tells us essentially how effective our STM is at removing the resist. And if we saturation dose that and then take it out, make a Hall-Barth structure and measure the free carrier density, we find it's the same. So we know that we're getting rid of that hydrogen resist layer effectively. Now finally, we're going to talk about a wire, which is essentially starting to get to this situation where we're crossing over from the classical to the quantum regime. And these are the magneto transport measurements we've got are essentially the patch device in comparison with the wire device. So we have our resistance versus magnetic field, and you can see in both devices we have a slight peak around B equals zero. This is essentially the weak localization effect. So we have our sample here, we apply an electric field across the device, and we try and get the electrons to diffuse from A towards B. Of course, they're going to hit the dopant impurities that are sitting in the delta dope plane. And when they do that, there's a finite probability that they're going to maintain their phase memory and come back to the origin. And that causes essentially a weak localization, a phase coherent loop, which localizes the sample at that particular point. So instead of it getting from A towards B, it's actually localized within the crystal. If you now apply a perpendicular field to that, you break that phase coherent loop, and the resistance drops down. This is the reason why we get this peak in the magneto resistance around B equals zero. If we fit that to something called the Akami formula for disordered conduction, we can actually extrapolate the phase coherence length, and it's about 38 nanometers. So you can see whether the electron is traveling through the square device or through the wire device is essentially ignorant of what its confinement is. It's got 38 nanometers, it can form these phase coherent loops. In both devices, you get this peak in magneto resistance, although obviously the resistance of the wire device is higher as you'd expect. If you now cool this device down to millikelvin temperatures, you find that the phase coherence length increases as expected. And what that means is you can form more and more of these phase coherent loops within the device. If you look at the 2D case, we actually see that the resistance shoots up here at B equals zero. As you form more and more and smaller loops and larger loops, it basically localizes the sample, so the resistance shoots up at B equals zero. And if we fit that again to the Kami formula, we extract the phase coherence length of about 131 nanometers. And now what's happening is the electrons traveling through the device, essentially in the square device. Again, it's ignorant of the boundaries of that device. But if you look at the wire device, the 131 nanometers is larger than the width of the device. So it's actually starting to be constrained as it travels through the wire. It can no longer form those phase coherent loops. And if you look at the resistance, it saturates here. This is essentially the patterning of the STM confining the wire to the 90 nanometer dimensions. And if we measure the magnetic length, we can actually extract the width of the wire, which turned out to be about 90 nanometers, from this crossover point. So this is a beautiful result where we can use the STM lithography to confine it to 90 nanometers, see that in the STM lithography, and then confirm it with the electrical measurements. Well, that was kind of like our first stage. It's a fairly easy device to make a 100 nanometer wire. But what happens is we start to drop the dimensions of the wire. In all cases, we try and measure the wires as we make them with very dopant imaging, so we can see the spread of the dopants. And if we measured the IV characteristics, we found that we could get down to 27 nanometer wires, which is still Amickan behavior. And the reason why this is significant is at the moment, I think this is still the lowest resistance ohmic wire that's been seen in silicon wires. And there's a huge amount of work going on at the moment in silicon nanowires to see if we can make them smaller and smaller and still get ohmic conduction. What happens as you go even smaller? We've gone down to 6 to 7 nanometer thickness wire devices, and we find the resistance now gets over 100 megaohms. So it's becoming strongly insulating. We're trying to figure out at the moment what is it that actually limits the conduction in these wires. If we look in detail at these wires, we can see that when we do the lithography and then dose it, there are these areas where the phosphorus atoms are not getting in. So we get microconstrictions on the wire. One of the projects we have running in the group is essentially to try and dose along different orientations of the crystallographic structure, either perpendicular to the atomic rays, or parallel to the atomic rays, or actually at 45 degrees. And we're finding that we get different absorption characteristics of the phosphine in these wires. And that's something that's an active area of investigation right down to the nanometer level. The other thing that we're trying to do, and that can be done with this technology, is to start looking at ordering the dopants. So one of the things that's been predicted, if you can order the dopants in these devices, then the spread in the threshold voltage will drop. And that way you can get down to smaller and smaller devices and still have functional computer. There was a paper published last year in Nature where people were using single ion implantation with very large distances between their ions, of the order of a few tens of nanometers, and they found that this actually did have an effect. So obviously you go down to smaller and smaller devices, it's going to become necessary to move into the STM regime in order to be able to see if it still works. Let's go through a couple of the other glasses. One of the things, obviously, we want to start packing in the layer and make things like tunnel junctions towards heading towards single electron transistors. And several different tunnel junctions are being made in our group, and I guess the key question is here, if you look at the Bohr radius, it's about 50 angstroms. So really, you can make a tunnel junction around about 10 nanometers and it should work. But nobody's actually done that to date. So on the right-hand side here, we have a 17 nanometer tunnel junction, and we find that that still works. And we're now starting to pattern single electron transistors, and I guess one of the advantages of this technology is you can get down to 10 nanometer islands, has about 100 phosphorus atoms in it, but the idea really is that you have a very strongly conducting layer either side with a very good tunnel barrier in between, so you should get some nice characteristics. And just to give you an idea of that, this is a single electron transistor device. We've got these results very recently, so it's just in December last year. Essentially, we've incorporated the backgate onto our structure. We have an 80 nanometer island. And if we measure the IV characteristics, we see a very strong blockade region in the middle here. If we differentiate that on the right hand side, we actually get a peak, which we believe at the moment is due to resonant tunneling of electrons on and off this island in the middle. But just to give you a flavor of where we're heading in the future as well, I guess one of the advantages, I keep saying, is that you can actually see the environment of the phosphorus atoms during this process. But at the end of the day, you still encapsulate and take it out of the system. And what we're hoping to get this year, in a couple of months' time, is a new STM system. We can actually measure in situ the electronic characteristics of the devices. So you can artificially create defects near the dopant atoms. You can put surface states and interface states near the dopant atoms and see directly the effect that they have. And this is going to be crucial, really, to understanding what happens as you head towards the atomic dimensions of devices. And finally, I guess the other thing, just to highlight about this technology, is it's also not just compatible with phosphorus, but with many other materials as well. So you can either go to other dopants, or you can go to organics, and some people are actually starting to move towards biomolecules. Well, in summary, just one of the things I hope to have highlighted throughout this talk is that using an STM, you can get to the point where you can get down to atomic level precision in putting phosphorus dopants in silicon. We've demonstrated you can take the devices outside of the STM and they still work. We've made very narrow semiconductor wires, very narrow tunnel junctions, and we're moving towards SETs, obviously with the idea of heading towards single phosphor qubits in the ultimate game. And then finally, but not last, I'd just like to say thank you to all the people I've worked with. It's been an incredible effort. There's lots of very good PhD students and postdocs, and I think the linkage with the STM theory has been crucial for our understanding of the surface chemistry of this, so that's also been a very positive interaction. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michelle, for this excellent talk, and we have time for one question. Phil.
When you were doing the weak localization measurements, could you look and see if you had telegraph noise?
We haven't, no. It's on the agenda.
Right.
We actually started on our very recent devices.
Thank you very much, Michelle, again. And our third speaker is Professor Zhang from Stanford. All right. And he'll be talking about spin holotype.